Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 7 in our series for 2018, and today's date is Friday, March the 30th. Good Friday. First of all, I talked to Ryan Murtagh about the government's new global talent scheme, replacing the 457 visa program. Ryan is a CEO and founder of established Australian tech and retail management software company Neato, currently employing about 130 people. Ryan is questioning why the new scheme supports the top and bottom end of town, but ignores the huge segment of the Australian business landscape that is SMBs. Many businesses in this segment of the market employed people under the previous 457 visa scheme. And then I talk to economist RMIT Associate Professor Jonathan Boymel about the risks surrounding the Australian housing market. But first, let's talk to Ryan Murtagh.
And I apologise for the quality of his Skype interview, but it's well worth listening to. Ryan Murtagh, the government has introduced a global talent scheme for technology, science and engineering businesses, which will replace the 457 visa scheme. What's your view about that?
I'm really excited about it, and it's great that the government's being proactive in this space. It's you know, the 457 business scheme is something that we used for a number of years, and have used actually since we started Neato. We've got a number of employees that are currently employed under it. So it's great to see that they are being proactive and they are, you know, testing something new. The only thing I would say is that it's great for startups. It's great for the big guys, but for the smaller technology companies like Neato, I feel like there's a little bit of a gap in this scheme in terms of it supporting businesses like us. So, I guess the threshold of $180,000 a year for a business based in Brisbane is a little bit high, and we feel that we can find global talent that are willing to come and work in Australia for the lifestyle benefits that Australia offer for potentially a fair bit less than that. So we as a company will struggle hire with that threshold.
I guess there'd be many other businesses in the mid-range would be struggling to meet that level as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking from experience too in terms of we've hired hired over 10 of our staff now on 457 business visas. And, you know, yes, salary was an important point for them, you know, coming to NITO, but lifestyle opportunity and, you know, the opportunity to work for a technology, you know, and I still class us as a startup outweighed the fact that, you know, they might not be paid $180,000+ a year.
Where are these people coming from?
So we've hired people from all over the world. So we have people coming from the States. We've had a number of people from Asia. We've got some people from Poland, from Holland. So yeah, really all over the world.
These are all tech people, obviously.
Yeah, and that, there's a big range within that. So, you know, within the technology space, we have engineers, we have product analysts, we have security analysts, we have data analysts. So it's not necessarily software developers like a lot of people might think. It's actually quite broad, the spectrum of talent.
Well, it's interesting because a lot has been said about the skill shortages in Australia, and I notice there seem to be fewer and fewer people now doing computer courses now, which is sad. And so we have fewer and fewer specialists.
Yeah, and probably fewer and fewer specialists, but also people that have got, you know, the experience that is necessary for a business of our size trying to compete on a global scale. So what we do find, you know, especially in countries like Poland, which, you know, there's a huge investment in tech in Poland. There's a very big startup community. There's, you know, a very big tech community. And therefore, there's a lot of experience. We're not able to get that level of experience here in Brisbane or Australia, even for that matter, yet. Especially in the product space, we're finding too. It's really, really hard to find experienced product managers, product analysts, etc. down under.
Right, because we're simply not producing them. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we're simply not producing them. And also, in terms of, you know, I guess where Australia is in terms of its maturity in this space, you know, we're not as mature as a country in terms of, you know, highly technologically advanced businesses, especially in the startup space. At least that's what we feel in sort of the area that we play in, which is, you know, digital commerce. There's very few digital commerce startups in this country, and therefore there's very little experience in that space.
And so, therefore, we need this expertise from overseas. But this would also be an issue in other countries as well. I would imagine it would also be an issue in the States and in the UK.
Oh, yeah, and it's an extremely competitive environment over in the States. We know we've been looking at expanding to the States, and, you know, there's a lot of negative sentiments around the culture amongst startups over there in terms of the competitive nature of the industry and the lack of loyalty between, you know, businesses and their employees because of that. So it's something we don't want to have to do if we don't need to, if that makes sense. We want to stay here as long as we possibly can, but in order to compete, we do need to be attracting, you know, the talent that enables us to do so.
Back to the government's changes. I mean, they replaced the 457 visa scheme. I mean, how effective was the 457 visa scheme for you guys?
Extremely effective. Like I said, right now we have over 10, and we're not a huge company. We'd fall into the SMB bracket. We have around 130 staff, and over 10 of those are currently employed under that scheme. So extremely effective. And another thing that's probably important to note is, you know, some of our very early hires came through that program. We would never have been able to attract that talent if that scheme wasn't in place, because we didn't necessarily pay those employees what they might have been earning back in their local market, like the US. But the lifestyle opportunity that Australia was able to offer those people was far greater and far more important to them than the salary they were going to get from moving from the US to Australia and working for an Australian tech company. And that's what's concerning for me with the scheme, is that ultimately people like that are ruled out for us if we can't afford to pay the $180,000 a year plus salary. And being a Brisbane-based company, you know, that's it's hard to palate, because yes, it's maybe fine in Sydney and Melbourne, where salaries are maybe, you know, 30 to 40% higher and should be due to the cost of living. You know, this scheme, I guess, hasn't taken where the business is located into account at all.
But also, it probably doesn't take into account the mid-range businesses that can't possibly afford $180,000. And yeah, that would be true of businesses whether they're in Brisbane, Sydney or Melbourne.
And it's probably the largest sector of the market too, I would say. And maybe, you know, maybe there's less of those at the top end and the bottom end, which allows them to, in a more agile way, test and learn this new scheme. And potentially that's the reason why they've done it this way. And I sort of commend them for doing it as a trial, because hopefully, you know, by trialing it, you know, things like this will be found out, and we'll be able to iterate and improve, and they will, which is, you know, very much in line with new ways of working from a technology company perspective. But yeah, I do feel like we're sort of left out in the cold.
Well, this scheme will initially run for only 12 months. So what will you be doing over that period? Will you be making your views known to the government or through your association?
Yeah, and we have already. So we'll continue to do that. And I think, you know, actions speak louder than words, and we won't be able to hire at the same, I guess, rate we were, or at least we won't be able to seek our talents internationally at the same rate we were, because simply we can't afford to do so at that salary level.
Now, where's the strongest demand for these areas? I mean, is it for programmers? Is it for data scientists? Is it product managers?
You know, for us, historically, it's been in product managers and engineers. So senior engineers in specific technologies. I'd say those are the two areas that we've struggled to find talent locally, and therefore have had to, you know, seek it globally.
That's where the big gaps are.
Yeah, for us at least. I can't speak for every technology company, but in our space, finding product managers that have got, you know, digital retail or digital commerce experience of a few years that are akin to modern ways of working and development, and then engineers who have, you know, a number of years of experience in the types of technologies that we use, they're few and far between down under.
How long has this situation been going on with these skill shortages, or has it always been thus?
Well, it's always been, you know, for us, it's always been the case, especially as we get into the more senior roles. So obviously as a very early stage startup, and I think this is why this program is very good for early stage startups or for true startups, it was a little bit of a different situation because we weren't necessarily looking for people that had that same level of experience as we're looking for today. So we're looking for more senior hires now that have got, you know, 5+ years experience. And so that's become increasingly hard. But having said that, you know, we employed our first person on a 457 visa. I think it was back in 2012. So we've been experiencing, you know, this for quite a while now.
So you'll be letting the government know where it falls short, and you're going to hope they're going to fix up the scheme over the next 12 months.
For sure, definitely. And like I say, until then, we're just going to have to focus our attention locally, which is obviously what we always do first, and hope that we can find the talent here.
Well, Ryan, best of luck to you, and thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks, Leon.
Thank you. And now let's talk to economist Jonathan Boimel.
Jonathan Boimel, there have been issues about the Australian housing market, and there are talks that it's running at high risks. What's your view about that?
Well, we've seen in the year to date that house prices have fallen by about 1% across capital cities. Again, that's since the start of this year. Sydney has led the decline, a reduction in 1.8%. Melbourne's not far behind, a reduction in 0.5%. You've got to remember in the Melbourne context that this compares to the rapid double-digit growth that we saw earlier last year. So it looks like that the crackdown on interest-only lending is working. And going forward, as a leading indicator, we're seeing that housing finance is declining, and that's driven by a reduction in investor finance. So I'd expect to see these moderate price declines to continue. That being said, there's probably no real relief for people in Melbourne and Sydney who are looking to buy a house. It's probably too late. We've seen growth in prices of established houses outstripping income growth for quite an extended period of time. So people might want to look elsewhere.
Nonetheless, companies such as UBS are saying that the crackdown on things like interest-only lending could actually cause a credit crunch. What's your view about that?
Well, I think we're always concerned about the impact on wealth from these sort of changes and the downside risks to consumption that might result. I'm not particularly concerned. If you look at the price declines to date, I don't think it's sufficient to rattle the economy. I think housing prices remain underpinned by supply-side factors and demand-side factors. On the supply side, we've got zoning laws, development restrictions. On the demand side, we know we've got population growth. We know we've got preferential treatment of housing as an asset. So I think, if anything, we'll see a soft landing rather than significant concerns about credit crashes.
Nevertheless, the households are very, very indebted. I mean, the household indebtedness is very high. How big a risk is that?
Look, it's a significant risk. And if you take a look at the most recent RBA meeting minutes, that is recognised. So the Reserve Bank of Australia won't be in any hurry to increase interest rates, even though interest rate markets are still pricing in an increase in interest rates. If you think back to when we had our last cut in interest rate in August 2016, unemployment was 5.6% then. It remains unchanged. So I don't see the Reserve Bank running in and increasing interest rates, both again because of the state of the economy, declines in wages growth, contributing to lower inflation outcomes. Wages growth, we know, is 2.6% over last year. That's near record lows. And again, the Reserve Bank of Australia very conscious about how small changes in interest rates could impact consumption on the part of highly indebted households. So I think, yeah, Reserve Bank is going to be very, very cautious over the next few months.
Nonetheless, the Fed is increasing rates. It's just brought in recently brought in a rate increase. We're looking at, say, 4 rate increases this year, and that will surely have an impact on other central banks, won't it?
Look, I'm unsure about that. If you take a look at where the Australian economy is in relation to the US economy, there are significant wage pressures emerging in the US. Unemployment there is at a 17-year low. In Australia, we've got significant excess capacity in the labour market, not just from unemployment, but more importantly from underemployment. Underemployment, we've got part-time workers who want to work additional hours but can't find those additional hours. Underemployment is close to an all-time high. We've got lower inflation expectations than they do in the US. It's a very different environment. And I think the Reserve Bank of Australia would quite happily accept a reduction in the exchange value of the Australian dollar. So interest rate differentials with higher US interest rates leading to greater capital inflow into the US, driving down the Australian dollar, can only help to boost exports from Australia and actually drive down what is probably an unacceptably high level of both unemployment and underemployment.
Nonetheless, Peter Costello, our former treasurer, has pointed to the high indebtedness of households as a significant risk factor.
Yes, it is a significant risk factor. There's no doubt about that. But the question is, what else is going to change? And again, the Reserve Bank is going to be very cautious. They're well aware of the established relationship between changes in household wealth and changes in consumption. And keeping that in mind, I think it's going to be one of the major criteria that they use when deciding on interest rate settings going forward.
Now, the other interesting thing is about house prices. I mean, they remain high, although the core logic data indicates that they're moderating. What's your view about that?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see a hard landing, again, because of both the supply side factors and the demand side factors that I mentioned before. You know, we've still got strong population growth, driven in part by relatively high levels of immigration. We know that housing has preferential treatment in terms of its role as an asset. I don't see that going away. I don't see the government in any rush to reduce the capital gains discount or abolish negative gearing or to include owning occupied housing in the age pension assets test, or to be honest, to reducing the migrant intake in the short run. So I think this puts a floor underneath house prices. We know that we're not just dealing with a national market for houses, we're dealing with local markets. So we're likely to see some differences in the submarkets in Australia. I think certainly Sydney has further to fall. Melbourne has further to fall. We've seen prices in Brisbane relatively stable. House prices in Brisbane have been relatively stable. Haven't moved, in fact, since the start of this year. So we will find differences in house prices as we look across Australia, but I would not expect that either at a national level or in any one particular state we'd see significant declines in house prices over the next several months.
But what's interesting, though, is that you've got runaway house prices in Hobart and Canberra, and that's holding up the figures. So, I mean, when you look at the overall decline or the overall moderation, you have to take Hobart and Canberra into account, and if you took them out, the decline would be far bigger. Yeah,
exactly. But it's interesting. You tend to see that when house prices in Sydney increase, people tend to leave New South Wales and go to other states. So there are lags in that mobility. I would not expect to see that level of outflow from New South Wales to the other states over the next few months, again, given the significant reduction in house prices we've seen in Sydney. So I think those differentials will moderate in the coming months.
So you're expecting New South Wales will pick up? House prices in Sydney will pick up again?
No, I think house prices in Sydney will probably stabilise, and we won't see the growth in house prices, for example, in Hobart that we have seen.
And the same would apply to Melbourne?
Correct. Absolutely. Melbourne, again, still has a bit further to go in terms of a decline in house prices, particularly given the double-digit growth in house prices on an annual basis that we saw at the start of last year. So Melbourne still has a way to go, but again, don't expect a hard landing.
So in summary, you'd say while there are risks, it's not actually catastrophic, and we can expect a soft landing in the housing sector.
Exactly. Look, if the Reserve Bank of Australia continues to act cautiously, and I expect that it will act cautiously, concerns about wealth impacts on consumption spending are unlikely to be realised.
Right, and so what we're in for is rather a moderation rather than a crash.
That would be my expectation, yes.
Well, Jonathan Boymell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
So what's happening in the news? Well, a Trump administration calm offensive to ease investor fears about a potential international trade war by talking about its constructive economic talks with China to reach a trade deal helped global markets rebound this week. That said, stocks fell again after the Trump administration once again fanned the flames of a global trade war amid new reports that it could move to block China from investing in certain types of US tech companies. On the plus side, reassurances from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin that he was negotiating on improving trade relations in good faith with China's Vice Premier and President Xi Jinping's closest economic advisor, Li He, reduced investor anxiety. The Trump administration is urging China to lower tariffs on cars and open its market to US financial services as part of talks to resolve a rise in trade tensions that has shaken global markets. Mnuchin called Chinese Li He to congratulate him on his appointment this month as Vice Premier in charge of economic policy, and the two discussed the trade deficit between the two countries and committed to finding a mutually agreeable way to reduce the gap. Trump wants to see a $100 billion reduction in America's trade deficit with China this year, as well as action on intellectual property.
The US had a $337 billion trade shortfall in goods and services with China last year. The US push to negotiate a détente with Beijing comes after Trump's plan to slap tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese imports sparked a sell-off in US stocks last week. Economic talks between the two superpowers have been stuck in neutral since a meeting last year through their main vehicle of negotiation known as a comprehensive economic dialogue, and that ended without a joint statement. Trump ordered the tariffs after his officials concluded Beijing engages in a range of policies that violate US intellectual property. The president also asked Mnuchin to come up with restrictions on Chinese investments in the US. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has publicly confirmed it was investigating Facebook. Facebook's stock fell 5% on Monday after the news broke. Facebook has attracted the FTC's scrutiny over the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Now, Cambridge Analytica is a British political marketing firm that illicitly obtained data on up to 50 million Facebook users that it used to try to influence voters during the 2016 US presidential election and the Brexit vote. It isn't the first time the FTC has investigated Facebook's privacy practices. The agency looked into the company's practices several years ago and found them wanting. In 2011, Facebook entered into an agreement with the FTC that regulated how the social media company treated its users' privacy. With this latest investigation, the FTC will be looking at whether Facebook violated that agreement and whether it violated any FTC regulations more broadly in its dealings with Cambridge Analytica. And Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg has reportedly bowed to pressure and has agreed to testify before US Congress on the massive data leak. Now to Australia, and the government has scrapped plans to get its flagship $65 billion tax cuts bill passed before Easter because it can't secure the last two Senate votes that it needs. Independents Darren Hinch and Tim Storer were still undecided on the bill, leaving the coalition with 7 of the 9 crossbench votes it needs. Finance Minister Matthias Cormann confirmed in the Senate that the government was making a tactical retreat as it couldn't persuade the 9 crossbenchers to get behind the bill, reducing the corporate tax rate from 30% to 25% across every business. The latest development is a blow to the government and business after days of raising confidence that it could get the bill through and comes despite support from business leaders and days of intensive negotiations. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, told a gathering of chief executives that the government was still committed to delivering the tax cuts. Well, the government now plans to restart the talks after the budget is introduced on May the 8th. And with Senators Hinch and Storer holding out for a better deal, the government believes it can reach agreement with 9 of the 11 Senate crossbenchers. Labor, meanwhile, has pledged to repeal any legislation reducing the tax rate for corporations with turnover above $50 million from 30 to 25%. And Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen said it couldn't be implemented before the next election anyway, as they wouldn't come in until 2019. Now, more than 300,000 low-income retirees will be spared from Labor's plan to scrap cash payments for excess franking credits after the opposition amended the policy after a lot of political pressure to exempt full and part-time pensioners, as well as every pensioner who's currently a recipient from a self-managed superannuation fund. The backdown, badged as the pensioner guarantee, will reduce from $11.4 billion to $10.7 billion, the revenue the policy was estimated to make in its first 2 years, and from $59 billion to $55.7 billion, the revenue it was slated to earn next decade. That's a fall of $3.3 billion. Now, Harvey Norman's dairy company, Kumbuna Holdings, has gone into receivership. The furniture and electronics retailer says the directors of Kumbuna appointed Ferrier Hodgson as administrators of the dairy company and its subsidiaries. It comes after Harvey Norman's profit took a $20.7 million before-tax impairment hit from the Kumbuna joint venture in its half-year results in February, weighing on the group's bottom line. Now, Oz Minerals has lobbed an offer for ASX-listed copper junior Avanco Resources in a deal that values the Brazilian-focused company at $444 million. Oz Minerals has a pre-bid acceptance deed with Appian, which has an 18.45% holding, and that is Avanco's largest shareholder. And and Ivanko's board has unanimously recommended shareholders accept the proposal. Now, Telstra is facing a $10 million fine over its premium direct billing service, which allows customers to purchase online content from third parties and receive the charge directly on their mobile bill. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission launched legal proceedings against Telstra, alleging that thousands of Telstra mobile phone customers between 2015 and 16 unwittingly signed up to subscriptions or charges with third parties without being required to enter payment details or verify their identity. And the ACCC says Telstra has admitted that it misled customers by charging them for digital content, such as games and ringtones, which they unknowingly purchased. Now, Telstra earned about $61.7 million in net revenue from commissions on premium billing service charged to more than 2.7 million mobile numbers. And Telstra ceased to offer PDB on the 3rd of March. And with Steve Smith and David Warner getting banned from playing cricket for Australia for 12 months as a result of Cricket Australia's investigation into the ball tampering incident, the Australian cricket team's cheating saga has leached into talks at the highest level of government, and it could cost Cricket Australia up to $1 billion in the years ahead. Now, the saga has followed Australian leadership around the world. On Monday, Australia's Trade, Tourism and Investment Minister Steve Seobo addressed the issue with Australian media in London and admitted the subject had come up during high-level discussions with UK Trade Secretary Liam Fox. The reputational damage comes amid reports the scandal cost Cricket Australia the $1 billion it expected to rake in over the years ahead for television rights to the game. Now, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia's incoming CEO Matt Comyn has stripped three senior executives from the management team. And the three senior executives are going, with Comyn putting his personal stamp on the bank's team. Melanie Lang, the Group Executive of Human Resources, Kelly Bayer Rosmarin, Group Executive Institutional Banking and Markets, and David Whiting, Group Executive Enterprise Services and Chief Information Officer, are all leaving. Comyn now has four vacancies, including his old position of Group Executive Retail Banking Services on the 12-member Group Executive to fill. No replacements were announced, and Comyn made it clear the changes are about rebuilding trust in the bank following a series of scandals, which has all the big four banks being investigated by a Royal Commission. The bank also faces legal action over more than 53,700 alleged contraventions of anti-money laundering laws. And Comyn says he wants to rebuild trust and pride in Australia's biggest bank. Now, gold miner Newcrest will recommence mining at its Cadia mine in the New South Wales Central West after part of a tailings dam collapsed. But processing remains suspended. Newcrest was forced to halt production at its biggest and lowest cost mine almost a fortnight ago after the breach in the Northern Tailings Dam on March 9th resulted in material flowing into the adjacent Southern Tailings Dam. The miner said it will recommence mining, but processing remains in a halt, with the company still considering recovery options such as diverting tailings into the old Cadia Hill open pit mining, which is no longer operational. The gold miner previously confirmed it will miss its full-year production guidance and said it will be unable to satisfy contracts for copper concentrate product because of the Cadia mine closure. And finally, Qantas is mulling the idea of introducing new passenger amenities on their super long-haul flights. Qantas CEO Alan Joyce said the airline is considering a sleeping berth cabin class and dedicated exercise areas on those extra long flights to London and New York. Those initiatives would help battle the fatigue of a non-stop 20-hour flight. And he told an aviation club of a UK luncheon in London, "We are also looking at, do we need and should we have four classes? Is there a new class that's needed on the aircraft? Could some of the freight areas we may not use be used as an exercise area? Could they be used for berths for people to sleep in?" And Mr. Joyce said Qantas was working with both Airbus and Boeing on aircraft payload range performance. Now, Mr. Joyce was speaking after Qantas had started direct flights between Australia and London, passing a major milestone by reducing a long trip to 17 hours and making it the first non-stop passenger service between the continents. And that's it for this week. And next week, we're going to have a great interview with Ryan Gracie. He is the marketing manager for the Catch Group, which has just expanded into New Zealand. So that's a terrific interview. In the meantime, you can catch up with us on Twitter at TalkingBizBRZZ or on Facebook. Take care, and I'll talk to you next week.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.